as the fundamental step to be the same, that's where I see how the bias is important compared to my fundamental unit step. Yes?
Why do you say that the average step is square root of d sigma squared and not r0?
But that's just a choice. It is just I'm defining my fundamental step as this average here, right? It's and we see that microscopically, that's what I see. Microscopically, that's what governs the behavior at short distances, right? So if I want my short distance behavior to be fixed because I want to fix my UV cutoff, then that's what I should do. If I want to fix my IR units, then I would fix RC. Yes?
Should that be a square root of G in the below the equality sign?
R equals
below the equality sign here, yes, n is t. Yeah. Sorry. If I use small n is going to be t all the time. It's just that I think of how many steps n. So, but t is also a time, it's also a natural, right? Yeah, if ever I write small n is t. Okay. Good. So, annoying. Okay, so today I want to study this probability after t steps of being at position r exactly. I want to find examples where I can compute it exactly compared to approximately like we did here. And I want to first compute it exactly and then take the large R limit. Right? So let's try to see if in some examples we can compute exactly what this probability is after t steps and then we take the large R limit to see that things work and as they should. And another thing I want to do is to compute a partition function which would be a sum of closed random walks. Right? We saw that these closed random walks would be relevant for Ising model. So we could define some partition function. It's like a sum of polymers. And we could define this model sum of closed random walks. And that's an application of the technology we are going to derive. Okay? We want to sum, say a model where I sum over all possible random walks, right? Not exactly polymers because we do allow them to cross, but some kind of long molecules, and we want to compute such partition functions. Okay? So that's where we are, what we are aiming today. Okay. Good. Yeah, there's one more thing we want to do. So the first thing actually we are going to do is to study a generating function of paths. To introduce this concept of a generating function of paths. Okay. So let's start there. So let's define a random walk generating function, that's definition. And the definition is that G that depends on some parameter, I think in the tutorial was mu, so I'm going to use mu, and R. And I'm going to define it, this is definition, as saying that I sum over times t, mu to the t times the probability of being after t steps at position r. Okay, good. Now, let me emphasize a couple of things here. So first, this would be what we would write for some kind of partition function of a polymer with some energy density. Because you see that this is what? This is nothing. But if I write this as this quantity is like summing over a length of my molecule, right? And then I have mu to the t, I can write as e to the minus beta times some energy per unit length times the length of my polymer, right? So I'm just setting mu to be e to the minus beta rho, right? Times number of molecules of length L, everything, divided by number of molecules of length L from connecting 0 and R, divided by the total number. Right? And so I'm basically summing, so this would be like my energy, and this would be an entropy factor. And so this would be a natural quantity, not only from an evolution point of view, but from a sampling point of view over all possible paths of a given site. Right? So we are thinking more from a time evolution point of view, that I have t that is growing, that we call it time. But it's not so different from a statistical mechanical model where I say I sum over random particles that need to go from this point to this point, but whatever, they can do whatever they want. And where we are computing such summing and computing some entropy and some energy. Okay, so that's one comment. The second comment is that if we could compute this quantity exactly, then when mu equal to 1, this quantity also has an interpretation. Now in the random walk picture, when mu equal to 1, g is equal to the average time spent at R, which is a little bit non-trivial, but you were asked to think about this in the tutorial, right? So how do we think about this? We say that if you think in an infinite, it's the average time spent at R in an infinite walk, because the probability after t steps of being at position R and stopping there, normally we think that we stop, right? Because after t steps, we are at R, and in my mind, I imagine that I'm stopping, right? But you don't need to think you stop. You say, I have a walk which is infinite, and what's the probability after t steps of being there? Well, the rest doesn't care. The rest doesn't matter, right? So this probability is the total number of paths downstairs, and upstairs are the total number of paths that after t steps are at R, and then they do whatever they want, right? And so by summing over, I am at R at position 1 or position 2 or position 3, I'm computing the average. I'm computing how many times I'm there. And therefore, it's really the average time that I spend at that position. Okay? So it's another reason that if I could compute this, then I set mu to 1 and I get a physical quantity. For example, if this blows up, it means that I'm on average, after an infinite walk, I pass by the origin many times. But if this quantity is not 1, it means that in a random walk, there is a finite probability that I end up passing by a second time in an infinite time, right? So for example, in one dimension, of course, the average time spent at the origin in an infinite walk is infinite, right? Because I go left, right, here it's again, right? You can imagine you are just moving left and right. Of course, you pass by the origin many times, infinitely many times in an infinite long time. So of course, this quantity blows up. And indeed, you compute this quantity and it's infinite in one dimension. And it's also infinite in two dimensions. That's less obvious. But in two dimensions, you also always come back to the origin many times. But in higher dimensions, for example, no. Because you have many space to explore, you start exploring. And in infinite time, maybe you will pass one more time. Maybe you will pass two more times. So for example, a curious computation that you are going to do tomorrow is show that, for example, in three dimensions, right, this average time spent at the origin is approximately equal 1.52, something like that. So on average, you spend 1.52 seconds at the origin in an infinite walk. So yes, you typically come back, but sometimes once, sometimes twice, very rarely three times in a walk. It's a finite quantity, right? And it's infinite in d equals 1 and 2. Okay? Meaning that you keep passing by the origin. Okay, so that's the motivation for studying this quantity, and let's compute it. Well, let's compute. So we computed the probability there. So let's write this quantity down. So this quantity, g of mu and r, right, it's equal to the sum of from t equals 0 to infinity, mu to the t. And then let me write the Gaussian, and let me write, I will write down the Gaussian as, well, let me write it, 1 over 2 pi t sigma square to the power d over 2, I'm putting the normalization factor, e to the minus r square over 2 t sigma square, right? That's the computation we did there. I'm putting now r0 equal to 0. Yeah, today we will always be here. Today we have no bias. And so that's the computation we got. Remember, that's what is there in the first line. This is equal, it's useful to write it in Fourier, it's equal to the integral dd momentum over 2 pi to the d e to the I q r minus q square t sigma square over 2. I just wrote it in Fourier, the same expression, it's the Fourier transform. Because in Fourier, t appears just here, so it's trivial to do the sum. And so we can just explicitly do this sum, and this sum becomes the integral d dq over 2 pi to the d e to the I q r over 1 minus mu e to the minus q square sigma square over 2, right? I just did the explicit sum of the geometric series. Okay. And here, of course, we are using this approximation of large distances. And this is approximately equal. Okay. So now let me explain this a little bit slower. Okay. And now, if r is large, q is small, the q that dominates. So if we are at large distances, I can expand that small q, and I will write this as some constant times integral d dq over 2 pi to the d. And then downstairs I expand, so I get q square plus some constant, and this constant I call m square, e to the I q r. Okay. And that's what we, and this quantity is the inverse correlation length. And we call this because this quantity behaves as e to the minus m absolute value of r at large radius. Now, yeah, so let me just make a small comment that here, by this large radius, I mean large radius much bigger than the lattice spacing. And here, by large radius, I mean radius much bigger than 1 over this correlation length. So if this correlation length is very small, this is much larger than that. So this is true when this R is finite in units of this correlation length. This is really even larger. So there are two length scales. One where you are not seeing the lattice anymore, you coarse grained, and the lattice details are not important. And one where furthermore you take the large distance behavior. Right? So here is the point where the lattice details are not important. This is a universal expression. And that's the result of this generating function for any distance, provided the details of the lattice are not important anymore. And this is furthermore when I am at my when I consider the large distance behavior, that's how this correlator behaves. Okay? That's the tail, that's the asymptotic.
Can you show how to get these approximations, the first approximations?
This?
No, the
this? No, here it is just large R means Q small. So I just expand in Q. Right, this exponential gives 1 plus Q square, and then the constant I just rename and the Q square. So I keep Q square and constant. And then I put Q square times 1, which means that this constant contains whatever multiplies Q square. And the rest I define as m square, right? So this m square is some m square that depends on the microscopic parameters, which was k and sigma, right? It's some function of k and sigma. But in the end, this function is all I care, okay? And so the idea that at the end everything is governed by m, in the end it's all about m, this is the idea of universality that we saw already before. Namely, we start with a super complicated distribution, doesn't matter, we coarse grain, we get to a Gaussian, and at the end, for this quantity, this correlation function of paths, the only thing that matters in the end is this effective parameter, m. Okay?
That's the inverse correlation length.
Yeah, so I call this inverse correlation length because you see that this behaves like this, and e to the minus, by definition, this is distance measured in units of definition of correlation length, right?
But does that...
So that's a definition of a correlation length, is what is downstairs, and the mass appears upstairs, so it's the inverse.
And does that correlation, that partition function have the interpretation of correlation between something?
Right now, defined as it is, it's a sum over paths. But it is, in fact, we will see tomorrow, or maybe on Monday, that on Tuesday, that it is exactly a correlation function. But for now, it is an effective length scale, right? Because these paths from 0 to r, this decays exponential with this length scale. So it is a length scale. It's setting a length scale, right? If r is much bigger, if r is of order xi, I get a finite result. When r is much bigger than xi, it goes down to zero. So it sets a transition, right? So it's a correlation length. It gives the average size.
Yeah. Do we have an easy way to compare the correlation lengths to the lattice spacing? The lattice spacing would be...
Well, the lattice spacing here is 1, but if there was a lattice spacing, it would appear here. So this 1 would be the lattice space. We will just keep it. It will appear in our probabilities. So sigma square, if you want, is proportional to the lattice spacing, right? Square. Yeah.
So,
sigma is roughly the lattice spacing, right? Sigma is the average size. Sigma is basically the lattice spacing.
So we have directly by the expression. Can compare.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why is this m squared statement of universality? Can we
repeat that? Because what I'm saying is that the correlation functions, this generating function of paths at large radius, all it cares is about this number, m, right? So in that sense, that's the sense of universality, is that even if your distribution could start with many moments, many parameters, at the end of the day, what do I need to know in this formula is what is m. The idea of universality is the idea that I start with a lot of information, And at the end, this information is washed out, and the final results just depend on a few effective parameters. That's precisely what we are seeing here. Everything ends up being encoded in this correlation length, and that's it. Okay. Now, let's recover these results, both this one and the probability, the Gaussian, by doing some exact computations. So we did some approximations. Let's do some exact computations now. Okay. Any question?
So what is the, is it M is, the one over M is much smaller than the latest spacing or much bigger than the latest spacing? The correlation length.
The correlation length can be many things, but in particular, the correlation length can be very large.
Very large.
M can be very small. If M is very small, the correlation length is becoming bigger and bigger, right? The correlation length is the inverse of the mass, right? So we can make the correlation length, we can tune the correlation length and make it big, right? If we make the correlation length big, then, right? So we start with a lattice. And then there is some lattice spacing, one. There is some correlation length, some typical correlation length sky. And what this means is that when R is much bigger than one, I don't see the lattice. It looks like just a table, right? Like a smooth, something smooth. And I am at some position here and here, right? And this is R. And I don't see the lattice anymore because I have many lattice spacings, right? So a million lattice spacings, so it's smooth. And then when I compute in this table a very long distance, right, I see that the result here behaves as e to the minus the distance divided by xi. So this xi is the definition of what we call correlation length. Whereas if I take the continuum limit, but then I'm studying a finite r, I get something finite, nothing special. Then I get to the tail when this r is large.
So the computation that you just did is for Gaussian random walks.
As we know, for large radius, it doesn't matter. So if the radius is large, they have two big Gaussian random walks because they can only, for large distances, we get this universality.
So these T steps.
So here we can assume that R is already kind of big. Otherwise, the statement that it was Gaussian to start with was already not exact.
So basically, this is the generative function after we have done some iteration of RG.
Or then you should say that I'm starting with a Gaussian walk. So we can say that either the walk is Gaussian to start with, then it's exact. Or if I want to say it's any walk, then R needs to be large because we need to have done already some iterations without changing the result. Yeah? So now, for example, I'm going to compute this quantity exactly for a discrete walk in a lattice. Right? So we don't start like there. We start really, let's compute from the beginning in a lattice. Let's compute Pn, and then let's sum it exactly and see what we get.
So that correlation length is the one that you would... That's related to M, right?
Yeah, that's one over M.
Okay, and does M have some certain kind of distribution, or because you wrote that M square is a function of kappa?
Okay, let's compute it. 1 minus mu e to the minus q square sigma over 2. This is equal to 1 over some constant. Why do I call it 1 over? Because there I said it's constant. Times q square plus m square, where plus order q to the 4, where m square equal, help me out. So I expand, I get q square is something like 1 minus mu divided
sigma
divided by mu sigma squared over 2. Right? Is it true? Did I do a mistake? Sorry? Someone is protesting? No? Okay. Good. Yes.
I can't see physically on the lattice what that correlation function means.
What the correlation length means?
Like that correlation length means. When it's like physically on the lattice, what does it mean? How is it related to, like, if I give you 2 points in the lattice, what does it tell me about those 2 points on the lattice?
So as we said, for example, there, it says that more than these equations, let's see. So how can I express it? So if I think of this as really being polymers that grow, right? I'm saying that if you separate them a lot, becomes very unlikely that they can, these configurations become very suppressed. How is this suppression growing? Effectively, when the radius is very big, it's governed by this correlation line. Now, on the lattice, I mean, this is what it is. This definition of this sum over all possible walks decays exponentially with distance with this correlation line. So I define the quantity, and then I saw it behaves like this. So you can also, I don't know, more than this.
Should that be a Q squared?
Sorry?
Should that be a Q squared in the question?
Yeah. Here?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's go here and compute this exactly. So let's assume that we have some probability of giving step r, which is equal to, let's do something a bit different. Let's say it's some pi if r is equal to some ri, and it's zero otherwise. Right? So this, for example, this pi could be 1 over 2d, for example, right? And we could say that there is a probability of moving to the neighbors, right? If ri equal plus minus any unit vector in any direction, for example. So that's an example, right? But it could be more general. It will move maybe neighbors and next neighbors, and you could have some pi's. The only thing I impose is that the sum over I of pi is equal to 1. Right? Otherwise, it includes this case, but it includes more. Yeah? Okay, good. So now, let's think. What's the probability of being at psi t plus 1 at position r? Right? Or let's write... let's put position T at position R. No, T plus 1, okay. T plus 1 at position R. Well, at position T, I must be separated from position R by one of these RIs, right? So this is equal to the probability at position T of being at R minus RI, right? Times the probability of jumping in the right direction, which is small pi, sum over I. And also, what's the probability of being at position r at step 0? Well, at step 0, I am at position r equal to the origin, right? I start at the origin, so it's 1 if r is the origin, 0 otherwise. Okay. Now, this implies the following, the first equation implies the following. Let's multiply by mu to the t and sum over t, right? Let's multiply by mu to the t and sum over t. So we take the equation, multiply by mu to the t, and sum from t equal 0 to infinity of that equation. So let's see first on the right-hand side. On the right-hand side, the right-hand side becomes equal to the sum over I, small pi, and then this generating function that depends on mu at position r minus ri. And the left-hand side, right? The left-hand side, you see that you have t plus 1, but you multiply by mu to the t, right? But you want mu to the t plus 1 if you want to reconstruct the generating function. So you multiply and divide by mu, so it becomes 1 over mu, right? 1 over mu times mu to the t plus 1 times that, but mu to the t plus 1, once I sum, I get... Now the power is correct. I get the generating function of mu and r, but there is a small mistake. What is the small mistake?
T equal to 0
is missing there, right? Because there, when t equal to 0, it starts with p1. So I need to subtract the contribution at t equal to 0, which is just, as we saw, delta r comma 0. Yeah? Is it good? And therefore, we get the following. We get the equation that I'm going to write in this way, that I sum over r prime, all points, then I'm going to define a matrix A whose labels are positions r and r prime. This matrix I multiply by this generating function g of mu and r prime. So I think of this guy as a vector and this guy as a matrix. And then this is going to be equal to delta of r comma 0. Okay? And let's see, so for this equation to be true, so I'm putting delta of r comma 0 alone. So what is this matrix A? A, right? A of r comma r prime is equal. There is a term which is a diagonal term. If r is equal to r prime, right? That's one term, which means that when I sum, I get back g, right? The delta function. And then there is another term, which is minus, when I put together, sum over I, mu, p, I, delta of r being equal to r prime minus r I. Okay, so now, is it minus or plus? Help me out.
Plus because you...
So I sum over r prime, and after I sum over r prime, So I sum over r prime, that argument r prime becomes r, yeah. Do you agree? And so, we conclude that if I think of this as a matrix, and this guy as a vector, and this guy as a, just a, right, as a vector whose first component is 0 and everyone else is 0, first component is 1 and everyone else is 0, we conclude that our propagator is given by inverting this matrix, right? So our propagator R is the origin. Our propagator is equal to the inverse of this matrix. Our propagator that, yeah, is equal to the inverse of this matrix. Element R, R prime times delta of R prime comma 0. In other words, is equal to my prop, the inverse of my matrix from 0 to R. Now, so that's the propagator. The propagator is just the inverse of this matrix A. And the point is that this matrix is translation invariant. It only depends, you see, on the difference between radius, right? Either the difference is zero or the difference is Ri. And therefore, it's trivially diagonalized by going to Fourier space. Whenever something is translation invariant, you diagonalize it by going to Fourier space. And you invert it by going to Fourier space. So let's write the inverse right away, and we check that if it works. Before doing that, let me just make a comment, because let me just make a comment that let's suppose the path did not start at the origin, but started at some other position. What would change? We have translation invariance, right? So let's suppose I replace this by saying that I have a propagator, and I go all the way to R prime, but starting from R double prime instead of origin. The origin goes to R double prime. Right? What would change? Well, I'm just shifting everything from origin to R double prime. The only thing that would change is that here there would be R double prime for the origin. Here there would be R double prime. And then here there would be R double prime. And so the probability of going from R double prime to R, the propagator, is given directly by the inverse whose entries are R double prime. So what I would say is that the inverse, what sits here is there's nothing special with the origin. What we have is the inverse of a matrix from initial position to final position. Because it's translation invariance, we can put one of them to be the origin and just put the length, but there's nothing special about the origin, right? So. Okay. So we conclude that G, our G, is just the inverse of this matrix, and here is the inverse. So we can write explicitly G of mu and R equal, let's write down and then we check, to the integral d dq over 2 pi to the d, where here I integrate over the absolute value of each q is smaller than pi. We will check that this is correct. Times e to the I, by the way, this is called the Brillouin zone. E to the I q dot r divided by 1 minus mu sum over I P I E to the I Q I R I. Okay. So that's the solution. And now we check. Okay, so let's check. Right, so this is claim, and then we check the claim.
So the R's are kind of unrestricted, they can be as large as, you know. So why is it that when we're doing the Fourier transform, we are mm-hmm. only integrating over the Brillouin zone?
Yeah, actually, that's a good question. Sorry, give me a second. Yeah, I was trying to be a little bit too general, but I want to. Yeah. So I want to take this R to belong to a cubic lattice. So we have a cubic lattice. The probability doesn't need to be just neighbors, but we can jump that from one point of the cubic lattice to another. But I'm assuming in this that I am in some lattice. I am in a cubic lattice. Okay? So these are I's, right? These are I's are vectors with integer entries. Right. For example, Ri could be 1, 0, 0, if I'm just moving to the left, one unit, right? Or it could be 1, 1, 0, 0, 0 if I'm moving in the diagonal, right? But they have integer entries. I'm not moving, it's not a continuous walk. It's a walk in the lattice. The point moves in the lattice. Okay? So implicitly, when I think of these discrete models, that there is a discrete number of possibilities, I always think that I'm in a lattice.
Does this generalize to crystals? So taking the
brick, yes.
So should the crystal.
Yeah, it generalizes. It doesn't need to be cubic. What's special about the cubic lattice is that the dual lattice is still a cubic lattice. And so things are easy. For a crystal, for another lattice, the dual lattice is not the same as the original lattice, and the Fourier analysis is more interesting. But here, everything we are saying is simple. So, okay, so we will see that that's an important point. If we had not said that, we would realize in this check that something is wrong. But now we will see how this plays a role. So let's check. So I take this propagator and I want to check that it obeys the right equation that is now covered. So what? So we want to check this defining equation for G, that when I act with A, I get just delta of R comma Z. Okay? So let's check. Let's multiply by A. So A is this matrix, right? So we want to check what happens when I do A dot with G. I want to contract A, R, R prime with G at R prime. Okay? Now G, the dependence on R is just here. So all I need to do is to act on this exponential, right? When I sum over R. So what do I get? This quantity is equal, right? I just sum over R prime, right? It's matrix multiplication. I sum over R prime, and that sum goes inside all the way to this exponential, and I get the following. So I get sum over R prime. Let me copy this. Delta R comma R prime minus mu sum over I pi. Delta of R is R prime plus these RIs, which have integer entries. This times R prime times E to the I Q dot R prime. And the rest outside is the same, right? So times this is inside the integral d dQ over 2 pi. To the D, and everything is divided by, I can put here, 1 divided by that stuff. 1 minus mu sum over I pi e to the I Q-I-R-I. Okay, so we might actually have to fix a few signs, and we will see it in this derivation.
Those Q-I's are what?
This Q-I is Q. Q dot R-I. That's a function of Q. Q dot R-I. Okay? Sorry. First, there is no Q-I. Okay, so let's see what happens. So what happens when I act with this? So this delta function here, so this quantity here, is equal to what? So the first term just gives e to the I qr, right? I sum over r prime, sets r prime to be equal to r. And the other term sets r prime to be r minus ri. And so the other term gives minus mu sum over I pi e to the minus e to r prime is r minus, so plus I q dot r minus I q dot ri. Correct? You agree? And therefore, this is just equal to e to the I qr, I can factor out. And then 1 minus mu sum over I pi e to the minus I qri. So as you can guess, there was a wrong minus sign, so let's fix it. You see, there is a minus here, so I want to put a minus here. So the claim was wrong, there was a missing minus sign, please put it here. All right. Minus sign missing, right? So here there was a minus sign missing. I'm putting an arrow here in case you are writing your notes so that you can correct it. But now that we fix this, we see something nice. We see that this thing cancels completely with this thing, right? That's why we design it like this, right? So this thing cancels with this thing. Yeah, and therefore, the only thing we get, I will not even write it down, it's just this integral of this quantity. That's it. Nothing else. Right? And you see now that r is a vector of integer quantities because we are in a cubic lattice. Right? So this r is an int, it's an integer, as integers, as entries. And therefore, this integral gives zero, right? Because e to the I times 10 q from minus pi to pi gives zero, right? Unless, what's the way out? If r is zero, right? Unless, if r has any component that's not zero, the integral over that q gives zero, right? And therefore, the only way out is if r is exactly zero. And when r is exactly zero, this integral from minus pi to pi d times gives 2 pi to the d, so it gives 1. And therefore, this is indeed equal to 1 times delta r comma 0. Right? And here it was crucial that r was integers. Right? If r were not integers, then it's not true. So that's here at this step that we are using, that we are in a cubic lattice. Only now, only at this step. Everything else will be okay, but the step, the statement that this integral here is this discrete Kronecker delta, now we are using explicitly that r are integers, right? So this here, it's crucial that r is a vector, this r vector is a vector in integers to the d, right?
If we are not in the cubic lattice, can we have some corresponding similar way to do it?
Yes, we can. Then you should choose a basis that is dual. You pick an integration over some q, and this is here q is integrating over an hypercube that's called the Brillouin zone, and that Brillouin zone is the dual cube to the fundamental lattice. You take your fundamental lattice, you dualize it, and you have a fundamental cell, and that's the Brillouin zone. If you start with another lattice, you dualize, you get another fundamental cell. That fundamental cell has this property that if you integrate over it, you pick just the origin.
Okay.
right? But that's how it would work, right? By the way, notice, for example, imagine we put the lattice spacing. Imagine I want to say that R is in integers times A, where A is a lattice spacing. So A for us is 1, but this would be, I put A. What should I change? If I want to say the lattice spacing is not 1, which I can always choose, it's my units, I chose. But suppose I say it's A. What should I change?
That 1 in front of the delta should be A?
No.
2 pi A over T.
Sorry?
I think that the integral measure should change.
Exactly. So if we put A, right, so what do we have? Let's be careful, let's write here in the corner. So if I have integral e to the I, and then a times an integer n times q, right? A is an integer, a is the lattice spacing, n is the position, q, and I want to integrate over q from minus some number to some number, and I want this to be delta n comma zero, right? So what should we do? So when n is one, when a is 1, this is my, this integral should be over 2 pi. But when we rescale by a, this should be pi over a, pi over a, right? What matters is the shift is not important, but it should be pi over a. And then there should be here divided by 2 pi over a, right? So we see that the Brillouin zone, when A would be naturally defined from with a size 2 pi over A. Okay? Which means that when the lattice spacing is very small, the Brillouin zone effectively becomes from minus to plus infinity. Now, but we say, oh, the lattice spacing is 1. So what does it mean, the lattice spacing to be very small? Equivalently, it's like saying that the radius is much bigger than the lattice spacing. Right? What matters is not by itself, because it has units, but it's how big it is compared to the distances we are considering, right? So we should expect that when we consider very large distances, the Brillouin zone doesn't matter, and that's indeed what we see, that we can take any key, and as we will see now, okay? Okay, so we checked, so this was the claim, and the claim was correct once we fixed this minus sign. So this is the correct, the exact result for this generating function. Right? And you see that this result doesn't look the same as this. It looks different. Right? So why is this the same result? Right? So I got that result that was exact. And we got this result here. And we are saying they are the same. Okay, so let's see how they are the same. Now, they are supposed to be the same only when the radius is large. Right? So we have to see that when they are the same, they better give the same result. So let's study this universality. Let's check this universality that things are working out. Okay. So we have that when R is large, Q is small. Right, we are doing an integral, R is huge, right? So that oscillates like crazy. So unless Q is very small, that integral is zero, right? It's a crazy oscillation. So the momentum needs to be very small when the radius is very large, right? The usual thing, large momenta, small distances and vice versa. And so Q needs to be very small. And therefore, if I want to study large radius, I can expand the denominator. And I can write that 1 minus mu sum over I of pi e to the minus I q dot ri, right? I can see this expand, and I can write this as 1 minus I q dot ri minus q square over 2 r I. No, q dot r I square. Plus dot dot dot. Right. And now you see that we have to use. Now we use that we have, on the one hand, sum over I of pi equal to 1. But also, what is sum over I of pi ri? Why?
Because star takes plus minus.
Because it didn't need to be, but we are assuming no bias. Remember? We said that today we have no bias. This is R0, right? Our bias we are setting to zero today. So no bias. And therefore, this term gives 1, this term gives 0, and I get just a quadratic term. So this becomes 1 minus mu from this product plus mu sum over I pi r I mu r I nu q I mu q j nu, where I'm summing over q I, or I'm summing over mu and nu, but not over I. And this is nothing, in the same way that that was the bias, this is nothing but the definition of our C2 mu nu, which we said was sigma squared delta mu nu.
So Q's should not have any I's, right?
Q's should not have I's. Why do I keep putting I's on Q's? That's weird. Okay, so then there is a sum over I, actually. So it's okay, which is written there. Okay, so this is nothing but the second momentum, right? And there was an over 2 that I forgot. And therefore, I get a constant times q square plus m square, where m square is precisely given by this quantity here. Right? And therefore, that's indeed perfectly the propagator, again, at large distances like we promised. Right? So that's what we wanted to show. And notice here, right? I had some probabilities, totally irrelevant, if it's just neighbors, if it's diagonal, what it is. At the end, I go to large distances, and all I care is this effective correlation length. In other words, all I care is this sigma square, which was the second moment, and I don't care about all these microscopic details. They get washed out, and we get to go back to this universal behavior. Okay, so I want to rederive this result yet another time because it's an important result. So I want to rederive the result in that box again without using this language of inverse of this matrix and so on. The inverse of this matrix is very relevant to see it showing up in this way. Because later we will see that in Gaussian integrals are all about inverting the matrices that appear in the Gaussian integral. And when we are going to claim that there is a duality between the Gaussian integral and the random walks, we will see this inversion of matrices showing up all the time when we are doing Gaussian field theory. And therefore, it will not come as a coincidence when we will find this object again appearing in a different context, and it will be the inverse of some matrix, it will be some propagator, And therefore, it's useful to have this derivation like this. So this derivation is already anticipating the duality that I told you about in the first lecture. But there is an even faster derivation that I'm going to discuss now. So let's do another derivation, which I find cute. Another derivation. And the other derivation proceeds by writing down right away the exact result for what's the probability after t steps at being at position r. And let me show you how you can write right away this probability. You can say that this probability is the following. Let me write the result, and then we explain, we put the words that we attach to it. I'll write right away. I'll say it's the integral d dq over 2 pi to the d from in the Brillouin zone, okay, of the following sum over I pi e to the I q dot ri times the same thing, sum of pi e to the I q dot ri, and until the same thing, and we put d such factors, t factors. In other words, it is just this factor to the power t. But I want to put it, to write it like this for explanation. Okay? Let's see, why is this true? Why is this formula true? Because let's see what this formula is doing. It's saying that if I want to go from 0 to r, it must be a sequence of steps. I must do t steps, and I go with some probability p1 here, then some probability p2 I go here, and so on. And I do a bunch of steps until, after a bunch of steps, I end up at the r that I want it to be. Right? So suppose that's the r I want to be, and I want to go there in t steps, right? So what is that probability? Is the probability of doing 1, then 2, then 3, then so on, over summing over all possible paths, right? If I list all possible paths, then for each path, the probability of doing that path is the product of probabilities for each step. But that's precisely what this formula implements because of the following. Look that here I have all options for step 1. Here, I have all options for step 2. So when I open this up, right, if I open this up, if there are n options, I get n to the t terms when I open them up, right? But then, sorry, I forgot the term here. E to the minus I q dot r. R should appear somewhere. So here, there are many, many, many terms when I open them up, right? But now, what happens is that once I integrate, I get zero unless the exponents add up precisely to r. And when they add up to r, it means that I chose a path that the sum over ri is r. So I go here. Therefore, this is true. Okay? So that's it. This is true because we are using that the integral d q over 2 pi to the d of e to the sum over I of ri minus r times q is equal, just sets delta, Kronecker delta, that says that r needs to be equal to the sum of ri, right? And therefore, out of this n to the d terms, we take exactly the ones where the ri add up correct, right? And that's it. So this formula is correct. Right? But now, this formula, as we said, this is just t factors. So all this bracket is just, if I call this thing, this full thing A, this full factor is just equal to A to the t. Right? there are just t factors, so it's just a to the t. So what's the sum over t of a to the t? It's a geometric series, right? So we just do the sum and we get that box there. That's it. Okay? So again, g is equal to the integral d dq over 2 pi to the d times e to the minus iqr time sum of mu to the t, a to the t, but that's just 1 over 1 minus mu a. And that's the previous formula. In fact, that's not exactly the previous formula, but it's the previous formula. It's the previous formula once we just redefine q to minus q, right? It's an integration variable. I just shift q to minus q. In the previous formula, I did not have a minus here, but I had minus in the exponentials here, right? We fix this minus. So it's just q to minus q, we go to the previous formula. Q is an integration variable from minus pi to pi, so it's okay. Right? So that's another derivation of exactly the same result, but this one starts directly with a Fourier by noticing, by writing down this representation for the exact probability. And then we go back to, we just do the explicit sum. Yes?
Yeah, I'm not sure how, for example, this term A represents the probability of taking that step. I don't understand what the exponential factor means.
No, I'm saying that once you multiply many terms, right, you get some p from here, some p from here, some p from here, all the way to a p from here. So when you take one term from this product, it's a product of p's, right? And also an exponential of q times a sum of r's, right? Now, if that sum of r's is not equal to this r, when you integrate, you get zero. So the only terms that contribute is when you take one term from here, one from here, one from here, one from here, such that they do represent a path that connects zero and r.
Yeah, no, that wasn't my question. My question was, how does this term itself represent all the, like you said that this represents all options for step one. I don't
know
why that's so.
I sum over the options, right? There is from I to whatever are the possible options.
What does the fact that the exponential thing ever mean?
The exponential thing is a trick such that when I multiply many of them, I get exponential over the total sum. And then once I integrate, I project into the total sum being equal to r, right? So it's a clever trick to say that to choose the sum over all paths that add up to r, I multiply all of them, but each of them I put an exponential such that after I integrate, it projects out to the correct ones. And so I get a sum of product of probabilities for each correct path, which is by definition the correct result for the probability.
So this is very reminiscent of path integrals in quantum mechanics.
Yeah, that's right. There is. In fact, it's possible. Here I'm doing integer steps, but we could often take continuum limits where we assume that these steps are infinitesimal and the time is much bigger and derive continuum path integral representations for these subjects. So indeed, it's possible to write path integral formulations for random walks and so on, which is no surprise because, I mean, if there is anything more like a path, it's a path, right? Of course, path integrals should appear in paths, right?
But it's completely classical.
But it will be completely classical. It will be statistical mechanics. Yeah? Okay, so I would like to finish in the last 10 minutes with a computation of of what is the partition function for closed loops. So I'll do it there. Okay? So this concludes our analysis of open loops, and now I want to do closed loops. Closed paths. So what we want to do is to sum z, which, as we said, is a sum over paths, 1 plus path plus 1 over 2 factorial path times path plus dot, 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 which, if you think the paths are independent, it is just exponential of the sum over one possible path, over all shapes of one path, right? And then when I expand down, I get the gas of independent paths. Okay, and what is this quantity? So this is what we call, what we say, it's exponential of, now I'm going to assign a formula, and I'm going to say that this is the sum, I want to write it like this. It's a sum over all paths that in time t go from position r all the way to position r. Right? This could happen in any position r of the lattice. Right? So I'm summing over all paths that start at a given position and go back. Right? Let me say that, okay, so that's the sum over such paths that go from R to R. Now, for each path that goes from R to R, right, when I count the path, this counts the total number of paths divided by, sorry, downstairs, total number of paths, upstairs, the paths that I want, right? So if I want to count only the paths that I want, I should multiply by the total number of paths of t steps. Okay? So let's write a total number of paths. So in this computation, here we are going to assume that pi are just 1 over 2d for the neighbors. Right? So how many paths there are with t steps? Yeah, 2d to the t. And now this is a total number, right? This is now a total number of paths that take t steps and go from r to r. Right? And is this a good definition of my sum over paths? Not exactly. I want to put some factor here. What would you put here to make this better? Not what I mean by better, I mean to avoid overcounting. So by the way, we would also put a chemical potential, like before, mu to the t. But then I also should put something here, something simple here, to avoid overcounting. So I want to do this sum. I want to sum over any t from 0 to infinity, right? Any paths of any possible length. But I'm overcounting, right? Why am I overcounting? Because you see that this path, if it starts here and I say this is one path that goes from here to here, right? It's also a path that starts from here and goes from here to here. It's the same path, right? And also, the path that goes from here to here, there could be the path that goes in the opposite direction, from there to there, right? So if I want to get rid of this overcounting, I should say that each path appears n times, or t times, if there are t steps, and twice, because there are both orientations. So I should put here 1 over 2t to avoid overcounting. The 1 half is the orientation, and the t is because it could appear at any position. Okay, so that's, if you want, our definition of the free energy for a single closed path.
Pedro,
yes?
The first two lines, the lines with the pictures, I didn't really understand what you meant with those.
So I'm saying it's a gas of loops. So it's 1 plus 1 loop, plus 2 loops, plus 3 loops, plus 4 loops.
Loops?
I sum over all possible loops, but they are independent. If they don't talk to each other, if they don't interact, It's like the partition function is effectively just the sum.
Oh, so each term is there's a sum.
Yeah, each term there's a sum. So this is just the sum over the number of loops, partition function for one loop to the n over n factorial, right? Because they are independent. So partition function for two loops is just product of two partition functions over two factorial, and so on. And so it just resums into the single loop partition function. Right? That's the usual thing when you have independent particles, right? It's like free, a gas of particles, right? It is just a partition function for one particle to the power of the number of particles, right? That's the usual things. That is, if things are independent, they don't care about each other. Just study one particle, and the combinatorics of many particles is just indistinguishable particles. You just raise it to the power n, and you divide by n factorial because they are equivalent. Okay?
And how?
But it's not crucial. I mean, what's crucial is this. It's a definition, right? I'm summing. This definition should be clear, right? This parenthesis here is sum over a single loop. By itself, it's an equally good starting point, right? If I want, I could start here and say I'm studying the partition function where I have some long closed molecule and I sum over all its possible shapes and so on. I don't need to consider a gas of molecules. I could study just one. So this could have been my starting point. It would be okay. So forget the exponential, and compare this picture with this definition, right? So that's what you would write naturally. If you want to assign a formula to this picture, it would be this formula, right? So that's the object we are studying. Let's call it F for free energy. So we study this F. This F is equal to this expression.
Just repeat to me where the 2D to the T term comes from.
This is a probability. So it's number of paths divided by number of paths that are closed divided by total number of paths. But if I want just the number of paths that are closed, I should multiply by the total number of paths. Now the product is the number of closed paths.
So every configuration in the so every configuration of the one loop that we're considering just gives one. That's the contribution, one.
Now, after I divide by 2t, each configuration gives one.
Gives one. Okay.
Times mu to the t. Yes?
So a path that crosses itself would be counted the first time when we come back the first time, and then a second time when we came again as a...
So crossing itself is nothing. There's nothing special about crossing itself.
The point where we cross it's on the one loop that has length 4, then a loop that has length, let's say, 2, and also on the loop that is length 4 plus 2, like, you count it. It's just, yeah, we count it a lot of times.
Yeah, it's. I think you are saying that here, there is one configuration that looks like this. This is one configuration in the gas of loops, if they don't talk to each other. And in here, there is a configuration which looks like this. That's true, but this has nothing to do with this. These are really two separate molecules that don't talk to each other. The fact that this point is closed, it's just a random point, right? They are independent here. It's a gas of independent loops. The molecules don't care about each other. This is like an embedded, like, yeah. There's nothing special about this versus this. Yeah?
Why do we have the mu raised to the power of t on the exponential there?
Definition. But physically, it would be the energy density per unit length. It would be for the same reason. If I want to define a gas, if there is some energy density per unit length of the molecule, right, then I should weight it with e to the minus beta times energy density times the length, which is like mu to the t. Right? Some chemical potential, if you want, for growing these molecules. If mu is very small, then t wants to be very small, and I want to have very small molecules. That's when I have a huge energy density, so big molecules are suppressed. And when mu is very close to 1, which means very small energy density, then I can have very big molecules, and there's no suppression of big molecules. So mu is a chemical potential that controls, will this be dominated by big molecules or small molecules? That depends on the material. Right? That's chemistry. More questions? Now we have 1 minute to finish the computation, but it's enough. because we have the probability, right? The probability is here, right? Going from r from 0 to 0 just means that I set this r to 0, right? That's the probability of going from 0 to r. If it's from 0 to 0 or from r to r, it doesn't depend on what r is. I just set this guy to 0. So that this probability here is just what's here in the blackboard with a to the t and without exponential, right? And so we can do this sum. It's almost geometric sum, but there is 1 over t. What's the sum of 1 over t x to the t? Without the 1 over t is 1 over 1 minus x, right? And with the 1 over t? It's log, right? Okay, so it's good. So we can write the final result. So we conclude that f is 1 half. The 1 half is because it's there. And then the summation over t will give a log. So the final result is integral d dq over 2 pi to the d log of 1 minus 2d mu sum over pi. Pi is 1 over 2d e to the plus minus q mu over summing over mu and over plus minus. That's the sum over I. That's that sum over there. P is 1 over 2d, and the ri's are just the unit things that we said. And that's it. So that's the expression. So the 2d cancels the 2d. And there is one thing that the sum over r, each point r gives the same thing. This is translation invariant, right? So what I wrote is not f, but f divided by the volume. The volume appears here, right? Because each r gives the same thing. Okay? So that's the formula we should put in a box.
So what do we mean by sum over mu?
Mu can be x, y, or z.
It's not mu.
It's not the same mu,
the chemical function. What, mu? Ah, no. Okay, of course not. No. Mu, I mean, what can... Mu. Mu. In other words, let's write this argument of the log. It's log of 1 minus 2 mu sum over the directions. It could be... mu equal x, y, and z cosine of q nu. Okay. Why don't I write explicitly, even more explicitly? So it's log of 1 minus 2 mu cosine of qx plus cosine of qy plus cosine of qz, if there are three dimensions. Right? So that's what the argument of the log would be. Right? Here it's in 3D.
What were the two?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Sum of two expand.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Huh? Ah, because I forgot an I here, right? Right? There was an I there, right? There is this I here. So when this R is E mu, right, it becomes E to the I Q mu. Okay? So that's the free energy. Again, let's write what this is. What we just computed here is the free energy. For free energy for a sum for a closed loop partition functions.
So
So it's a nice, it's a simple result. It's an integral. So this is what the partition function of this model would be. Like we solved in the first lectures, the partition function of the Ising model. Here's another partition function. It's a partition function for the closed loops. And this partition function takes a simple form. It's just an integral of a log. And we will see how this form, this same formula comes about tomorrow from a totally different model. And tomorrow we will see it like a mathematical coincidence, why the two models are giving exactly the same partition function. And then on Tuesday, we will understand what's going on and we'll understand why it's no miracle, because the two models are indeed dual to each other and there are no coincidences, of course. Yeah.
So you're dividing by V, that's the volume of space or?
Yeah. V is a number of points. Right? Because each R, this summation over R gives nothing, right? Each R gives the same thing. I go from point R to R or from this to this. It's all the same. There's translation invariant. So the sum over R just gives V. Yeah. Sum over the V is just sum over R. And I divide by V to say that result is because the free energy should be extensive, right? And we see it's nicely extensive, right? It's proportional to the volume. So the free energy per volume is a nice integral representation that depends on the microscopic details. Right? Of course, it's trivial to generalize to pi, right? I can put there, instead of 1 over 2d, I put pi. What would change if I keep the previous language, by the way? Let's just see what we would do. So suppose I want to keep the full generality. So this quantity here is a, right? If I want the full thing, right? That is a. What should change? What else should I change if I wanted to make it totally general? So A is okay, but here on this blackboard, what should I change? What changes here? Here, for example. What would change? Now I sum, but it's not just left, right, up, down, blah, blah, but I have any PI. Right? So what should I change?
The 2D.
The 2D, right? So if I want this probability to become the number of closed paths, I need to multiply by as many options as there are. So instead of 2D, what do I want here? I want this is the number of probabilities pi, whatever there are, right? However many there are, right? And that's what I would change, right? So this is A, and this 2D become the number of terms, the probabilities of pi, right? That's if you wanted the general thing. Okay, cool. So that's it about unrestricted random walks. We are done. So tomorrow, I probably will not summarize anything because we are shifting gears and going back to Ising models. We will finish tomorrow's lecture with the same box, but coming from a totally different point of view. And then next week, we will understand why the two are the same. So if you have any question about random walks, it's good if you ask me now. I'm not going to summarize tomorrow, I think. So you can think if there is any question here. No? Clear? Okay, so see you tomorrow.